Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Richard Davies, and before we start the show, I'm asking you for a little iTunes love. If you enjoy listening to us, then please rate and review us. How do we fix it? Thanks.
It's much worse than people think, and it was much worse than even I thought. It ends up getting invoked just to say, listen, I don't want that politician I don't like, that comedian I don't like speaking on my campus. So it ends up getting sort of weaponized and turned into a tactic in the culture wars.
What if we had a show about solutions?
Not the same old left versus right.
I am right,
I'm right.
And you are wrong.
Boring.
Yeah, something new.
Yeah, something new. How to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
So here's the problem, Richard. It seems like free speech is under attack more than ever before on college campuses.
College students increasingly demanding protection from words, ideas, and even emotions they don't like.
You know, and the emotions is the really key part. There's an ethos on campus today that if someone's upset about something, it's someone else's fault. And that we need to control the speech to protect people from some kind of emotional harm.
Our podcast is How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs. And our guest this week is Greg Lukianoff. He's a constitutional lawyer and the president and CEO of FIRE. That's the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. This is a group that has worked all over the country protecting the rights of students from speech codes, things being banned, all kinds of assaults on free speech.
And the thing that sparked this show was the cover story in The Atlantic, The Coddling of the American Mind. Greg co-wrote that with Professor Jonathan Haidt of New York University.
Yeah, and it's one of those articles that really kind of hits the zeitgeist, and it's really brought this issue, which has been bubbling for years, into focus. So it's great to have Greg on to discuss the problem, but also some solutions.
Greg's joining us via Skype from Washington, D.C.
So, Greg, how big is this problem?
Well, I'm a First Amendment lawyer, and I've been doing this for 15 years. And I have to say, it's been pretty bad and pretty ridiculous for a long time when it comes to the speech policing on college campuses. It's much worse than people think. And it was much worse than even I thought, coming from the ACLU and from a free speech background. I was still routinely shocked at how easy it is to get in trouble on the modern campus. But the thing that's changed in the past 2 years is that for the most part, it's been out of control administrators that have been enforcing sort of like unbelievably strict speech codes. But in the past 2 years, I'm seeing a lot more of the speech policing being taken on by the students themselves. And that's a very disturbing trend.
Give me a couple of examples, Greg, of how this has changed literally in the last 2 years.
Sure. Well, definitely one of the things that really first clued us in was the rise of sort of what we refer to at FIRE as disinvitation season, where suddenly there was just this spike of movements to get speakers students didn't like disinvited from speaking there. And this included even people like Christine Lagarde, who was head of the IMF, very accomplished woman if there ever was one, or the former chancellor of Berkeley. There was a disinvitation push against him. And it really, came to a head when they tried to disinvite Bill Maher from speaking at UC Berkeley on the day to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement.
Yeah, because some of these speakers that have been disinvited in the past were well-known conservatives, but Bill Maher certainly doesn't figure in that category. He's a well-known talk show liberal.
Exactly. And then there's a certain sadness to that, I have to say, that people kind of didn't notice it until it ended up being a series of famous liberals getting disinvited. But nonetheless, you know, it is more newsworthy when it ends up being even a comedian, you know, facing a disinvitation push.
Now, when we talk about the rise of students pushing back, there's a few different elements. I'd love you to explain them. One is the concept of microaggressions. What is a microaggression?
And microaggressions are unconscious, usually unconscious slights that you make that are either racist or sexist. Those are generally the two categories. So, for example, really emphasizing the fact that an African American speaker is articulate would be your classic microaggression, because it's sort of implicitly insulting. It's implying that that's kind of weird. So that's the microaggression that I think everyone understands.
Now, the other phrase you've mentioned is trigger warnings. What are they?
Trigger warnings are usually verbal warnings that you place in front of any material that a student might find upsetting or quote-unquote triggering.
So it's kind of like a warning label for speech.
It's like a warning label for speech. But the problem is the categories for what require trigger warnings just get bigger and bigger. And even though they usually use PTSD to justify trigger warnings, it's increasingly students who have no PTSD at all saying, I just don't want to hear about, for example, the law of sexual assault at Harvard Law School. One thing that made a lot of news was at Columbia, a series of students wrote to the president saying that Ovid's Metamorphosis required a trigger warning because it includes sexual violence and it includes racism and sexism.
Yeah, and in almost every major work of literature involves some kind of human conflict or trauma. And
one would hope.
you don't have a lot of drama without that. So I'm really intrigued by this idea that everyone feels they need protection from things that we used to feel were just part of the give and take of culture, that we're able to talk about really bad things, especially in an academic setting.
Right. And this is why we called it vindictive protectiveness, because it's taken on because the sort of speech policing has taken on a particularly harsh edge. And it's protectiveness in the sense that people tend to appeal to the fact that there's this other group that needs protecting. And then they can get, frankly, very aggressive in fighting to suppress speech that they think might offend that other group. So it's kind of a paternalism run amok.
The example that really struck me, I was kind of astounded by this, was that you can't teach rape law in a law school or in an undergraduate course on legal principles.
Yeah, that scares me to death. And I could see that coming even when I was in school and law school back in the late 90s. So this wasn't really that much of a surprise, but to have Professor Jeannie Sook write in The New Yorker saying that, you know, colleagues are coming to her saying they're not even going to teach rape law anymore because they get too many student complaints about it, its implications
are
terrifying.
What are the complaints?
That it's too traumatic for students to have to think about rape, potentially because some of them might be victims or some of them just might find it too, you know, quote unquote, triggering to listen to. And of course, who this hurts the most are victims of sexual assault.
So, Greg, in your Atlantic cover story from the September issue, one of the things that I found so fascinating was really looking into some of the psychology of what is driving students to be so kind of hypersensitive and feeling like they're in need of such protection. And PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, is one of those things that it seems like it's gone from something that a very small number of maybe military veterans or survivors of very extreme situations have, to where it's almost as if lots of people consider themselves having this. And I'm not just talking about, you know, rape victims, where you could certainly understand that. But it seems like half the student population thinks they've got some kind of psychological damage that requires protection. Is that a fair reading?
The numbers of students not necessarily claiming PTSD, but that are reporting anxiety and depression has gone up, depending on what study you look at, has gone up pretty dramatically. And when I talk to, for example, the dean of Yale Law School, he talks about numbers that are absolutely mind-boggling in terms of the numbers of students coming in that report either anxiety and depression.
So let's walk this back just for a moment. What is it that people want protection from? They want protection from anything they might find upsetting in speech? I mean, it seems bizarre at a university where you're supposed to go to learn new concepts and ideas.
Right. Well, it depends on the individual. It depends on the individual student. Some of them have a very narrow conception of what they want to be warned about. You know, it might just be sexual assault in some cases. They just want to know if there's going to be a rape scene in a book. But in other cases, and this is just natural sort of censorship gravity, essentially, it ends up getting invoked just to say, listen, I don't want that politician I don't like, that comedian I don't like speaking on my campus. So it ends up getting sort of weaponized and turned into a tactic in the culture wars.
Weaponized, that's a great way to describe it. And I think that term you use, the vindictive protectiveness, it's hard for people who haven't seen this to recognize just how intense these campaigns are, you know, often using social media to target and shame and humiliate a certain person or speaker and really drive them out of the zone of common discourse. Not just that you disagree with them, but they should be banished.
Yep, absolutely. We're also coming out with a documentary in which we interview John Ronson, who wrote that book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is specifically about the sort of vitriolic demonization that we seem to be promoting in society, that if we see someone that we see as a villain, even momentarily, or a political enemy, just how vicious and unproductive it can become.
Yeah, I want to know one thing, though. When we talk about higher education, very often we assume everybody's going to an elite campus, say a Dartmouth or University of California or one of the Ivy Leagues. How widespread is this really?
Certainly the prevalence of speech codes. The speech codes are extremely common. We estimate about 55% of universities maintain speech codes that would be laughed out of court. And that's from very extensive review. When it comes to the new phenomenon of, you know, who's requesting trigger warnings, it's so new that it's hard to know how common it is. And then there's an article after article of professors coming forward and saying, yes, this is a very difficult environment in which to teach.
Yeah, there was one great piece. I'm a liberal professor and I'm terrified of my liberal students,
right.
I remember saying.
And to be clear, it doesn't take a lot of students. It only requires a vocal minority to create a situation where people are afraid to say what they really think.
Now, not only are the professors afraid, but it seems that the school administrations are also really afraid. And part of that is that this doesn't just happen in an academic vacuum. The U.S. Department of Education is involved in this. Explain how that works.
Yeah, this is the secret engine of why you end up with the truly ridiculous cases on campus. And I talk about one case in which a student was found guilty of a racial harassment several years back because he was reading a book called Notre Dame versus the Klan. The book was about the defeat of the Klan when they marched on Notre Dame, but he was nonetheless found guilty of racial harassment without so much as a hearing.
And this was because of the cover of the book?
Because of the cover of the book and the name on the book. It made an employee uncomfortable, and that was considered enough to find him guilty of racial harassment. Now, this is only possible in an environment like I've seen, where universities are incredibly nervous about harassment claims, and they're particularly nervous about running afoul of the Department of Education.
Yeah. One of the things that really comes out of your Atlantic article is the sense that, are we raising a generation of babies? Are we coddling people? There's a wonderful illustration in the magazine of a three-year-old child sitting as if he's a college student.
I feel a little mixed about that because I care so much about students, and I think that image is correct in the sense that I feel like we're doing these to a generation of students, partially by helicopter parenting, partially by K-12, and by emphasizing to students this really negative message that they are very, very fragile. This is also bad psychology. People aren't that fragile. Resilience is a real thing, and research into resilience is very powerful. And that's one of the reasons why we got into cognitive behavioral therapy, which basically says you don't want to teach people habits that create self-fulfilling prophecies of fragility. And that, I believe that's what we're doing.
So what we're seeing happen too often on campus then is someone sees something that they don't like and they say, I feel upset. I must be upset because you're trying to make me upset. You're oppressing me. You're marginalizing me. You're excluding me. And it's your fault.
Exactly. And that's the emotional reasoning part of it. You know, and that's part of CBT, part of cognitive behavioral therapy, is to say, you know, sometimes you're offended and sometimes something should be done about it. Sometimes it's just an emotional state. It's not really an argument. And by focusing so much on people's emotional states rather than the substance of their arguments, we've gotten very far afield from productive.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Discussion.
I want to push back on one thing, and sure, that is that a lot of the complaints about this could be coming from, and actually it's kind of a question, are they coming from people who have power?
Right.
So, I mean, most of the people in our society who are in great positions of power are still white men.
Right.
And so is this part of a national conversation about how to change our culture, how to move away from one sector of society having a large share of the power and other people feeling that they need to challenge that power?
I would agree, but the problem is that almost, I'd say probably 19 out of 20 times that the white privilege argument has come up, it's come up from very wealthy, usually white men, affluent students at affluent schools. And honestly, when it's coming from them, you start thinking, is this an argument or is this more of a tactic? Meanwhile, I think implicit in a lot of the sort of the microaggression theory and privilege theory is this sort of like paternalized, we have to protect people from actual discussion. Meanwhile, when I talk to, you know, we're coming out with a documentary called Can We Take a Joke? And the sort of starring comedian is this African-American woman, Kareth Foster. And she thinks a lot of this mentality, a lot of this talking on eggshells kind of phenomena is actually based in sort of insulting ideas of what minorities are actually like. And it prevents people from genuinely interacting with genuine candor with each other.
So the problem looks like it's pretty severe and seems to be getting worse. What do we do about it? I know you've got some solutions that you've discussed.
Yeah, I wrote a short book called Freedom from Speech. And the bad news is that I think that these are typical and predictable problems of a society where people can choose what media they listen to and increasingly can aren't as used to dealing with everyday sort of discomfort of disagreement. But what I think we can do is try to get people used to that again. And so one thing that I think would be very helpful would be formal debate. It's shocking that universities don't tend to do it already. But once you actually have to have a debate, particularly if you have to take the position that you don't necessarily agree with, it becomes much harder to sort of caricature people who disagree with you as either stupid or evil. I think we need some reforms with the Department of Education. I'm suddenly hopeful that that might be possible because of what President Obama said about this issue. He gave this great quote of talking about how that students shouldn't be coddled and that you should be exposed to people you disagree with and that you don't have a right not to be offended, essentially.
Can you just explain briefly how the Department of Education has exacerbated this with some of their the language they've used in their directives?
Yeah. Well, there's two different ways. One is that in something that they referred to as a national blueprint, they redefined harassment as being any unwelcome speech. And they specifically got rid of the reasonable person standard in that letter that they referred to as a blueprint for the country.
So that's pretty open ended.
Yeah. So basically the problem with that, of course, is if we were allowed to directly challenge that in a court of law as a speech code, it wouldn't stand a minute under the First Amendment. But it's hard to actually directly challenge the Department of Education. So universities are being put in this really difficult spot of enforce this code that really that can get them sued in a First Amendment lawsuit or face defunding or an investigation by the Department of Education. The other thing that they do is that the universities are so scared of being investigated by the Department of Education. The fact that the Department of Education has really amped up the number of investigations it does. I think there's like 150 schools currently being investigated. That, again, they tend to overreact. And if we could, our very simple solution for that, and it's a very simple one, is just define harassment the same way the Supreme Court defines it.
Well, what is that definition of harassment from the Supreme Court?
It was unwelcome speech that's directed at an individual that's severe, persistent, and pervasive, such that it effectively interferes with a student's ability to get an education. So it's a high standard, but it should be a high standard.
One of the other things you mentioned in your piece, Greg, was that universities should officially renounce trigger warnings.
Now, trigger warnings, when you put it entirely on professors to guess what might upset students, you put them in an absolutely impossible situation. So even when professors voluntarily use trigger warnings, I think they're running some risks that they're going to create an expectation that it will always be on the professor to protect students and guess what actually might upset them, which is, again, impossible.
You say that universities should also stop promoting hypersensitivity. Is that part of this?
I do. I think that the fragile student model is patronizing, insulting, and it's gotten out of control. I think that we're not doing students any favors by telling them that they're incredibly fragile. If you believe you're very fragile, you're more prone to anxiety and depression, for example.
So some of the ways that colleges promote this hypersensitivity is, you know, freshman orientation seminars and a lot of diversity training and these things. I mean, obviously, you don't want people to be rude and racist and probably in moderation. These are good things. But,
right.
But they've gotten out of hand, you think, and have started to promote people. So they become hypervigilant for any kind of offense.
It's one of these things where, you know, people talk about safe spaces, you know, and are very critical of them. But that's partially because I think we've gotten away from what a safe space was originally supposed to be, which is a safe space was supposed to be a place where it was safe to be wrong and to have candid discussions and to say to make mistakes and but to genuinely communicate who you are in a situation where you're not going to get in trouble for it. And I think getting back to that would be really helpful. As far as orientations are concerned, again, I really like the idea of having debates right front and center. But I also like the idea of having some amount that, rather than priming students that, listen, if you're offended, something really bad has happened, telling students like, listen, you're going to be challenged here and it's good and it's healthy and it can even be really fun.
Greg Lukianoff, constitutional lawyer, president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jim, I know we've been talking about free speech on college campuses, and this is a real problem, but I think it's part of something much bigger. Our culture is more divided now than it used to be. We refuse very often, liberals and conservatives, urbanites and country folk, to talk to each other, to recognize each other. I think that this is coming out of that.
Absolutely. And more, we are not only saying, I disagree with what you say, but you have no right to be part of the discussion about this at all. We want you out of the public arena and take your ideas somewhere else because they're not just wrong, but they're hurtful in some way.
And somehow we've made people we don't agree with into cartoon characters.
Right. And people have always done this. You know, we've talked before about, I think, a lot of political division is a kind of tribalism. You're in my tribe. They're not in my tribe. And I think on college campuses, you see a very, very intensified version of this where people are constantly looking to define who's in the good tribe, who are the good ones, who are the bad ones, because they got a lot of power if they can define other people as being somehow illegitimate.
But I do think that this problem has its roots in something genuine. Most people in positions of great power are white men, and that we're now seeing increasingly, and I think rightly, a society in transition that's challenging some of those assumptions about who has the right to authority.
And those assumptions need to be challenged, but training people to disregard discussion, not to debate, to shy away from any kind of discussion with ideas you don't like, that's not going to make them more powerful. What the point that Greg was making in this article is we're making people weaker. And the real implications here aren't just this is wrong and it violates free speech, but these students are being trained to be emotional and really political weaklings.
They're being coddled and not being prepared as well as they should be for the working world, for what's ahead.
What I thought was so fascinating in there is this idea that if somebody could say, that hurt me, that hurt my feelings, that's a trump card. You know, you can't really argue against that. And then if they can claim you have no right to have this discussion because I feel bad. And that's really where things are heading, of course.
course.
One thing that's really fascinating to me, though, is that on the one hand, it seems that college students may be more sensitive about all these things when they talk to each other than they used to be. But on the other hand, they're watching Game of Thrones. I mean, I just sat for a couple of months and watched all 50 with my wife, and that show is incredibly politically incorrect and very, very popular.
Yeah, there is a funny kind of schizophrenia in our society that we're hyper, hypersensitive to these issues of gender and violence and race and sex, and yet people seem to be really drawn to entertainment. There's nothing but that stuff. So to wrap up, let's look at some of the solutions Greg talked about. The first one I thought was interesting was this idea that schools should stop training people to be hypersensitive and instead teach them to be more proactive. You hear an idea you don't like, instead of raising the alarms and trying to get that person kicked off campus, debate it, argue it. And he even argued for bringing back traditional
debates. Debate club. I love that.
You know,
that's fascinating. Yeah. And then also universities should discourage or strongly discourage the use of trigger warnings.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I do think there's cases where people need to know. It's people who are genuinely victims of some kind of trauma. You know, they need to be careful about how they go through life. But this notion that this is such a widespread thing that everybody has to be protected, you know, it leads to a kind of intellectual agoraphobia. You know, people are afraid to do anything because they might encounter something that's mildly troubling. And we're elevating this sense of being troubled to such a high level instead of just like, yeah, the world's full of troubling things.
And I know you feel that the federal government plays an important role in this as well with its warnings.
Yeah. So the way the Department of Education advises schools on Title IX, and Title IX being the law that determines that you can't discriminate against people based on sex. But it has broadened out. I mean, it's a classic example of mission creep in the federal bureaucracy. And they've made it very, very vague. And the schools are terrified of the Department of Education coming down on them.
So the government should do something, schools should do something, and we should do something.
As Greg said, microaggressions can be real. That people aren't just imagining all this. So people need a little bit of a sense of humor. And sometimes if you say something, you know, you got to be willing to apologize. I was talking to a musician I know, a trans woman, who I knew before she was a woman. And she was saying some nice things about a band that I play in. And we were in this great conversation. And just unconsciously, she said something nice. I said, "Oh, thanks, man." And it wasn't until she'd walked away that my wife looked at me and she goes, "Thanks, man." You know, and, you know, I think she had a sense of humor about it, I hope. You know, it was inadvertent, but these things will happen. We're all trying. And I think being willing to just, you know, recognize it, say I'm sorry, that's part of the picture too. Everybody just needs to dial it down a notch, you know, instead of elevating it to a national or campus-wide issue. Just like sometimes a few words between friends or associates is all it takes to put these things behind us.
And that's our show, How Do We Fix It?, produced by Miranda Schaefer.
And our audio engineer is Denise Barbarotta.
No, Barbarita.
At Mono.
Mono Lisa.
Okay, and our audio, I just can't talk today.
I love this.
Our audio engineer is Denise Barbarita here at Mono Lisa Studios in beautiful uptown Manhattan.
And this show is produced by Davies Content, which produces digital audio for companies and nonprofits. I'm Richard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
Thanks for joining us.